Well, I learned one thing from that video. I had a lot less gray hair 5 years ago than I do now. That's what building projects will do to you right there. I want you, Southbrook, to give a warm welcome to this individual I have such deep respect and affection for. I actually heard his dad preach back in the 60s. Was my first exposure to his family. And Phil Ling leads the Ling Group, which is a church consulting group, the Giving Church Network. He has worked with Billy Graham, with John Maxwell, with Joe Osteen. He's had nearly 900 projects. He's married to Georgia. He has a son, Phil, and who's married to Lauren. And I just love this guy. He has been our consultant throughout this project alongside us. And I want you, straight from Omaha yesterday, to welcome Phil Ling to Southbrook, everybody. Give Phil a warm welcome. Straight dude. And Phil, I just really appreciate all you've done. You add an outsider's objectivity to this place. And for one who lives on the solution side of church, you know, whenever you're a leader, you live on the problem side. That's where I live. I don't see things objectively a lot of times in terms of positives. So I just treasure you, and this is the third time we've done this weekend, but I just, you know, I want to thank you before you head south today again. You get on planes a lot and off planes in your job. You were a church planter, a business entrepreneur. Now you're doing something I have a personal passion for, that is creating community, creating places where community and those intersections can happen. Why do you do what you do? You don't have to do this. You know that, right? You don't have to do this, but you do. Why?
I'm not very bright. I was in Salt Lake City just a few months ago, and it was about 7 o'clock in the morning, waiting for an early flight, standing there in line like you do, like cattle lined up. And this lady came up and says, "Mr. Ling." I said, "Yeah." She says, and she's got an outfit on, but she's not like the red coat for Delta. She's got just a business suit. And she says, "Do you know what flight this is?" I'm like, "The one I'm getting on?" I hope. She goes, "Well, this, you are, as of this flight, you have flown 2 million Delta miles domestically."
Oh, wow.
I'm like,
wow.
Dang. I don't know if you can say dang here.
Yeah,
dang.
You can. You've said worse, trust me. Yeah.
So domestic, I mean, you know, the international guys I see in the plane, they're going to Japan. I'm like, that's cheating. I go to Omaha. I go, you know, Peoria. But why I still do it? I've been blessed to work with all these churches, like you said, and all of them are doing good things. To quote Jim Collins from his book, Good to Great, all of them are doing good things, but some of them are the Southbrooks of the world, or the Aberrations, which are doing great things. And those are the cool ones that I still get jazzed to get on the plane. They're the ones that look outside the room, not inside the room. The average church in the United States, 360,000 churches, the average church has 90 people on Sunday at church. And pretty much they're all kind of related. If you show up at those churches, you know. And they're nice people, and they say how friendly they are, and they're very friendly to each other because they know each other. But those others that look outside, I'll push my book, which is free.
Which I think, let's give him a free pass on pushing his book.
Push my
when
book,
it's free,
which is free.
Right, Southbrook?
It's free.
Yeah, it's free.
So if you go, to thegivingchurch.com, you can download our book. And the story I'm going to tell you real quick is in this book. It talks about Pastor Ricky, one of those churches. Mm-hmm. I was there right after Katrina. Katrina slams into New Orleans and floods everybody out.
Let me stop you there because we contextualized this last night. What catalyzed that story in your mind was the fact that I said, and I hope no one sees anything but this at face value. If you don't have the local church in the world, you face New Orleans after Katrina and some of the things that happened there. That's what's going to happen
this in a political way, but if you think the government's going to save you, you're going to be
hungry.
Yeah,
that's exactly it. There's just some times where that's not going to happen. So that catalyzed this story. We weren't even planning on talking about this, but I said, please repeat the story of Ricky.
Well, and Katrina, because I was in Katrina, or not in Katrina, but in New Orleans right after Katrina also. And one of the things that we tracked is that almost every pastor resigned and left their church within 24 months of Katrina. It was just that hard, everything that was left. So I show up in Baton Rouge, and Baton Rouge is just down the road a little bit. They call it Baton Rouge. Baton Rouge, where Pastor Ricky. Ricky was a drug smuggler. He grew up in Baton Rouge, and he was a drug smuggler. And his story, if you read my book, you'll hear about his story, and he's got his own book about his life. He gets arrested, taken to the jail. This is before a life transformation opportunity. And he's nothing but shorts and a t-shirt and barefoot. And they have to uncuff him to fingerprint him. And he just thinks in his crazy head, what if I just started running down the hall? So he ran down the hall. And he ran out the door. And he ran into the swamp. And for the next 30 days, they chased him with dogs and couldn't find him because he's living in the swamp. And after he lost like 20 pounds, he said, I'm going to give up. and went to prison. Wow. In prison, a chaplain leads him to Christ. To this day, that chaplain's now on his staff of his church down there in Baton Rouge, reaching people like him. They bought an old nasty shopping center and redid it. And out front was an old Pizza Hut that they made into like a dorm. And it was for people getting out of prison to transition. And I said, so it's like a halfway house. He goes, no, brother, it's an all-the-way house.
I mean, it's an all-the-way.
But that's Pastor Ricky. So he's
well,
got
his
this
picture. What's the tell
okay,
about
okay, so his sign out in front
I
of
love
his
this.
Church is his mugshot. But it electronically shifts to what he looks like today.
Isn't that great?
He's
great.
He's cool. I've told a story all over the country, but he's a cool dude. So I'm there right after Katrina, and I'm asking him about it because one of the things they did, they had just finished redoing their church, which is this old shopping center, and before they could move into it, Katrina hit, and all these people flood out. Baton Rouge becomes the largest city in the state now instead of the second largest because they all got to leave. And they welcomed 563 people that had nowhere to go to come and live in their building that they had not even got to occupy. So they suddenly tore up their pretty little rooms and put in beds and washers and dryers and shower facilities. And for the next 60 days, 563 people, and he says, Phil, it's not like they brought us all the good ones. I said, you're like the mayor of your own town. He goes, no, man, I was a sheriff.
Wow.
And they kept every one of those, and they took upon themselves to feed them, clothe them. They did not take any government assistance. They did everything they could. They found family members around the country, put them on buses to send them to their family if they had family. I said, what was the biggest surprise? And this is why I still get on planes. And he says, how many church people I lost? I said, really? He goes, every week somebody come up, and they tell me they were leaving. And I said, what'd you do? He goes, well, first I'd hug them, and Ricky hugs everybody. And I said, then what? He said, why are you leaving? And they said, well, Pastor Ricky, you just care about Katrina people. I said, what'd you say? He said, I'd look at him, I'd hug him again. And I said, you're right, and so should you. The church is the only club that exists for non-members. The reason the church in America is dying on the vine whole is because they have become internally focused. And when you find a Southbrook or Pastor Ricky in Baton Rouge or where I was in Omaha yesterday that are looking outside, that are externally focused, that gets you on an airplane.
Yeah, that's cool. Isn't that a great story, man? Southbrook, latch onto that because that's who we want to be. That's who we want to be. That's who these people are, by the way. One of the things you add is a broad view of what's going on. We are living in an amazing era. And that is the church in America is dying. Certain scandals haven't helped, but cultural factors are in play. The phrase that Max Dupree coined, that a leader must intercept entropy constantly, has never been more true than now. And give Southbrook, so many people invest their time, talents, and treasure here, Phil. What are you seeing in the church landscape in America?
It's going to sound negative, and I don't mean it to be. If you read our book, and the book we released is the Coming Generosity Tsunami, and it's about the giving in America and how that's being affected and crushing churches with that tectonic shift. Because what we have done for the last 20 years, and I put myself in that bucket because I was a church planter, so you know what we have done as pastors for the last 20 or 30 years is create consumers of a product rather than stewards of something. And so because of that, most of the churches offer products. Some people like the product, they give a few dollars to it for a while, and then they move on to another product, and they are starting to die. So when we surveyed 4,000 churches from 30 different denominational backgrounds to look to see where their money comes from, doesn't come from, what that looks like, here's what we found. And I've not, everywhere I've been, it's corroborated our research. is that in the average church in the United States, 45% of the people that attend, so almost half, 45% of the people that attend, give less than $200 in a year to that church. You don't have to be rich to give $200 in a year. What's that, $2 a week? I mean, $4 a week? $4 a week? So why is that? Because they're not, they are consuming, and so occasionally they give some dollars, but they're not necessarily supporting. So for that reason, and then when you throw in that the people that leave church get mad and hug Pastor Ricky and leave, and somebody else maybe comes and sits in that seat, your attendance might look similar or even grow, but you're getting a changing face. So about 20% of the people sitting in church are not there in that church the next year. Somebody else is there. So it slowly starts to corrode. The first-time visitor doesn't give money for at least a year to a year and a half. The people that were there that maybe not giving that much to begin with anyway, and then they leave 20% every year. So the picture of the church in America, 90 on Sunday, 75% of all churches, less than 200 people on Sunday, it's slowly, it's an atrophy. It's just slowly dying. There are aberrations. Southbrook is an aberration. There are bright spots. There's, where sin abounds, grace abounds all the more. There are cool stuff. But when you look at us as a whole, we are Europe, just hadn't happened. Yeah. Europe's got beautiful buildings. We just saw one burn.
Yeah.
You know? $1 billion
which there's
collected.
No wood in that facility. Like, there's no wood to burn. No, I'm just kidding.
I was going to say.
No, there is actually wood in there, but boy, does that get your attention when you're building something.
And the world gave $1 billion to something they would never go in.
Yeah.
Isn't that interesting?
That is really, that caught my attention, yeah.
So the picture that I see is if the church doesn't have a clear, articulated vision, why we exist, and we're trying to reach people that don't know God, and if there is not a group of folks that are generously fueling that vision with intentional generosity, then it is doomed. And so what we're going to see are more and more churches that still have some folks in them, but their budgets keep shrinking until they can't open. When we came out of school, a lot of our buddies took churches that were probably 100, 150 mm-hmm. people, and they got a salary, and they were pastors of those churches. Those are pretty much gone.
Yeah.
They're gone. And so I can tell you cool stories like Pastor Ricky and like Southbrook, and then I can tell you the landscape, which is bleak.
And then add to that the generational deal, that the greatest generation, and then the boomer generation has funded these things, and we're all going to die, right? We're going to die, and there's a different reality.
One of the things, and I'm glad you reminded me, because one of the things that came out of this study, I've got a friend, Jay McCord, and he's a corporate speaker and works with corporations speaking on things, and his whole shtick is what I'm going to tell you. For the first time in America, we have four generations that are alive. First time. So multi-generational is cool. But that greatest generation that Tom Brokaw wrote about was like my Uncle Everett. My Uncle Everett was at Pearl Harbor, and he just died a few years ago. He was in his 90s. Well, that generation has had the baton that they're passing, which is the greatest wealth transfer in the history of the world. The group that's getting it are the boomers, and the boomers are the consumers. So it's taken longer for that wealth to transfer, and when they get that wealth, they do not see the church as being a wise place to invest for world change,
yes,
for life change. So for that reason, it's going to quickly go down. I worked with Billy Graham, as you said, for a while, and we had a lot of faithful people that literally supported that ministry for 40 years, around the world, had 52,000 die in 1 year.
Oh, wow.
First of all, wouldn't you like to have 52,000 donors?
Yeah.
But they died. And so that transfer happens. So you put all that together and look at the American church, and if the American church is not viewed as relevant, then it will not be supported. People do not give to what they do not believe makes a difference.
Yeah.
So when you do find one, like a Southbrook, to do that pitch, then you've got to fuel that vision.
One of the interesting things is we have so many people here who this has been their only exposure to church. They think this is normal. And this is not normal. It's very Abby normal, And, and then there are those of us who work and serve here, and we don't necessarily see always the abnormalities that are so positive. Why are you such a big fan of Southbrook? You may say this to all the girls, but I don't think you do. You really, it is one of your top places that you work with. And I think it's important that we hear that. Would you agree, gang? Why do you think that this is?
The reason. I love to tell the Pastor Ricky stories, and there are different cool stories. Here's what I'm looking for to see the health of a congregation. Jim Collins wrote a book years ago called Good to Great, and looked at corporations and a lot of good ones, and churches that call us are good, or they wouldn't call. Mm-hmm. You know, they got something to do. But then there are those ones, what I call the flagships. They hold up the tent pole. Mm. And Southbrook falls in that role. What I'm looking for, is there's a continuity of leadership. Every one of those great churches has a leader that's been there for a period of time. So Charlie's been here for like 47 years.
Feels like it.
But that continuity of leadership. So you cannot outrun bad leaders. So the leader that casts the vision, others can echo that vision. So you've got that. And then when it comes to a project, why are you trying to do something? So the project that you guys had, Reverie, which I think is what Astro on George Jetson says when he barks. It's a Reverie. Anyway.
That is such a great reference. If you don't know the Jetsons, I'm sorry.
You missed that whole thing. Go back, watch the Jetsons. But when I look to see a church say, what are you trying to raise money for? And I've had bad projects. You know, it's like they want to do stuff that helps them, like it gives them a better seat, a better parking place, or, yeah, you know, whatever. And sometimes you have to do that. But when you find a project that says, we want to look at touchstones. So when do unchurched people think spiritual thoughts? When babies are born, when people get married, when people die. So what if we poured ourselves into not a good enough project? Churches do good enough all the time. You know, you drive by churches that have signs talking about how great God is and their building looks like it's falling apart. Mm-hmm. So you said, let's build the Reverie. Let's do this beautiful chapel that's really tricked out, so when girls are getting married, they want to be there, and the groom's thing looks like a pub, you know, it's so cool. And and then they got the support facilities for the food functions and all those kind of activities to do it really, really nice, because unchurched people don't need two reasons not to come back. One will do. So let's remove stumbling blocks and say, we believe so much in this touchstone in your life that we're going to sacrificially give money to do something on this scale, yeah, so that you might intersect in a spiritual way with what's going on. Because churches exist for non-members, only club that exists for non-members. So when I see the project, say, okay, this is a selfless project. This is an externally focused project. We have continuity in the leadership. And then when we try to raise money, which we've been doing on this one day, which is really like day 2000 instead of day one. Yeah. It's true.
It's very literally true.
But when we did that, here's what I look for. We had a lot of generous gifts, but over 800 families at Southbrook gave money to day one. That's health.
Man, that is
health.
That is so, like, if you don't know churches, you may not understand how big that is. That,
in a church of this size even, you could see churches doing projects and maybe getting 400 families or something. And maybe you even have some very generous families. Maybe somebody gives you half of the money for the project. Some churches do things like that. They usually put their name on it, but, you know, somebody does that. But when you say, we're going to have some generous gifts, but we're not going to have somebody give half of the money, and we're going to get broad-based participation, that is a great church. So participation has to go first. The size of your gift has nothing to do with your standing in the family. So everybody get in the car and let's go on the trip. And when a church does that with continuity and leadership, with a project that is focused for people that are not here yet, that is a great church.
And I told you one of the biggest... most meaningful things that's come out of this for me was you said, Charlie, you need to sit down with the 100 top donors of Southbrook before this campaign begins and sit down and talk to them, cast the vision, and challenge them to be a significant part of this. Well, I don't know. The only people I know who give what is Sherry and I. That's it. But I embrace that. I'd love to talk to people. And what struck me about that was, first of all, a bunch of people said, we don't need to do it. We're busy. We're going to give. We're good. But how many people I had never met, and they're not wealthy, who are our top donors? They're not wealthy people. You think a church like this with all these Lexuses and Mercedes out in the parking lot, that it's all a bunch, you know, the whole thing's, but it's a bunch, that other 55%, they're doing it. They are doing it. They believe in this. And a lot of us get free lunch because they're doing a huge part. Now, I was enriched by that because of that broad ownership. You said, so is that why something Phil said is of the 900 projects you've done, this has been one of your favorites. It's been one of the most successful, is actually was your
right.
word. Explain the 11 million to 7.5 million with the 800 families that contributed.
Yeah, so when I look at the projects, I've been, like I said, lots of projects, big ones, little ones, $100 million all the way down. And every project has problems. Have you ever done anything in your house? I mean, my wife and I built a small house 18 years ago, and after about a year, I'd like to burn it down and start over, you know?
Yeah.
Because you learn, you know, through the process. So you can, when you do something on this size and scope, you can either do it on time or on budget. Pick. And so Southbrook says, we're not going to borrow money. We're going to do it on budget as quickly as we can, but on budget. And so then when you run into issues like, they come back and say, okay, everything that you want to do with your wish list of opportunities to touch this building is going to be like $12 million. And somebody like me that Jared quoted says, I think you can do seven.
Yeah,
you know,
that's a gap.
Exactly, there's a gap, and we're not going to borrow money. So then you find the ninja, who is what I call Monty. He's the construction ninja, and so Monty comes in and knows how to squeeze and say, "Okay, let's do this." But what you ended up with, and if I hope you get this, and doesn't this go over your head? So yeah, broad-based participation. You had a great project to begin with. But when we looked at the facility, your facility has issues too. Boxes always need stuff. Your roof needs fixed, all those kind of things. And so Monty was able to come in and say, all right, we're going to take that $7+ million, and we're going to do everything that was on the list that was going to be 12, plus we're going to touch just about every portion of this building with either repair or upgrades, children's areas, the bog facility. The bog facility is very cool. Mm-hmm. The Reverie,
Dunderwood.
It's just... almost everything, from the floors being run to everything's been touched, and every time you do that, the dollars go up. Most of the time when I see that, it's train wrecks. It's the other way around. And so the church then ends up wanting, somebody's talking them into borrowing a bunch of money, and they get upside down, and churches are not designed to carry lots of debt that way. So what watching this project, as Monty alluded to, and it's not smoke, it's true, for every dollar, you've got about $1.60 in return. To do that, staying with the pledge, we're not going to borrow money, and to get not just a few generous people that have deep pockets, but 800. When I asked Charlie to sit down with leaders, when I asked pastors to do this, the people that give, it's not to ask them for money. I don't coach anybody to ask for money. It's about vision. It's about sitting down in a room and giving them a safe place to ask you a question and saying, you folks, really, your generosity fuels so much of what we do for us to be successful. And when you give that vision to everybody, and when you give them all the opportunity to participate, and I say this every day to churches all over the country, and it's my soapbox, but I can tell how healthy a church is by how many people get in the car, not by how much money they raised. And when you get 800 different families to get in the car over and above regular giving to do this, and you got somebody like the ninja to be able to squeeze and get everything that you got, that's rare.
It is. It's huge. Let's just celebrate today, right? Southbrook, it's been a long journey, but let's just celebrate this deal. Go grab as many Bill's Donuts as you can handle in the area back there in a few moments. So here's where we are. We said we're going to do this debt-free. We are committed to that. We are about 24 miles in a 26.2-mile marathon. I want us to finish this. I think it would be a huge win with a church made up of so many of you who would not even be in church if it weren't for a place like this, because you're not churchy people, for us to finish this. So we're almost $500,000 short of being debt-free through this, or, you know, all paid for. And one of our families came forward and said, we will give up to $250,000 if Southbrook will match that to close that gift, to close that debt, that gap. And so here's where we are today. Everyone here, listen to what Phil's about to say, because if you do that, your part, with that family doing their part, we'll do this debt-free, which is amazing, amazing. So, Phil, tell us, yeah, tell us what...
It is rare. I want to brag on you, because so you know how special that is. Churches of this size usually encumber huge debts, even when they got good ideas. And so to be able to stay true to that... And honestly, if we'd have started this 5 years ago and said, hey, we're going to get about $11, $12 million worth of stuff, but we're going to have to borrow $500,000, I'd have raised my hand. Yeah. Said, that sounds like a good investment. Yeah. But Charlie and the leadership have stayed true. Said, no, we don't want to do that. And so then when one of our families came forward and said, to get us over the line, I will give, and this person's already been generous, I will give $250,000 to match up to that $500,000 so that we can finish this, put a bow on it. And when I told Charlie I would love to come back and share with you guys, here was my pitch. The only way that's going to happen and the only way you're going to have a cool story to really be a beacon to this community is if everybody in all three services does something. It's not about how much you do. If you belong to a club, I've never belonged to a club, I'm not a club kind of guy, but if you belong to like a country club, then occasionally they assess you fees based upon improvements. Mm-hmm. You know, we improve stuff, so you got to pay a fee. And how, if you got 300 members, they all got to pay a fee. The church is not a club where you have fees. So we don't look out and say, what's the attendance this week? Let's divide it by $500,000, and then that's what we need everybody to do. That's not how wealth is distributed. That's not how it works. It's based on God challenges us all to do something based upon how we've been individually blessed and to set aside on a regular basis. So what I challenge you to do in all three services is everybody do something. If your family could do $50 as a gift, fantastic. If you could $100, $500, there's some that are blessed and could do $5,000 or more. We got the one match, which is a generous, generous match. But this church was not built on multi-million dollar gifts.
Yeah.
It was built on huge participation. Remember, the size of your gift has nothing to do with your standing in the family. You're in the family. But if it's this important of a trip, then we got to all get in the car to go.
Yeah. I just want to say thank you to those of you who have fulfilled that mandate. 1 Peter chapter 2, verse 4 and 5. As you come to him, the living stone, rejected by humans but chosen by God and precious to him, you also, like living stones, are being built into a spiritual house. And, you know, churches are full of decorative stones. People are kind of out there independently, and they float from church to church. That stone looks great, but if it's not part of a wall, it doesn't have any real value. Some churches have destructive stones, which tear down walls. But so many of you are living stones, and you have a lot of stones on top of you. And I thank you for that. Last night, Valerie Sroziak handed me a check, and she goes, Charlie, this is from me and Bob. And Bob died this year. And she said, half of this is from me, but half of this is from Bob. And she's going through a really dark time right now. And I just love that, because that's the spirit of this place. That's what makes this happen, is everybody here who says, I'm a living stone. I'm a part of this wall, this house being built. And I could not emphasize more what Phil said. You be a part of that wall today. Campaigns are a great entry ramp to missions, aren't they, Phil? They're a great... Exactly. On ramp. And maybe today's the day where you get on the ramp and get into the mission here. You're a part of creating a safe place for D-Church skeptics to live like Jesus. And we want you to do that right now. Reverie means to be in a dreamlike state. The song you're about to hear, as you think about your push pay, your check, your amount, whatever it's going to be, the song you're about to hear, I've heard it 100 times because I have the soundtrack to the movie, but I've never heard it through the lens of this project. Listen to a song you've probably heard, but listen to the words through the lens of the place that many people are going to find Christ, because you were a part of that. And thank Phil for being with us today. What'd you gain?